As many of us know, can be a matter of life and death. About 15% of all patients are misdiagnosed, and many complain their doctors just don't listen to them. Science and medical skills are critical, but research shows patients also want care, simple care. A recent survey found that the most highly rated aspects of care was humaneness. So what can doctors do to listen better? And how do patients contribute to the relationship? What are the physical effects, physiology, of a good relationship between patient and healer? So let me introduce my guests today who are going to answer all those questions and more. We'll start with Dr. Larry Levitt. He joins me here in the studio along with his partner, Dr. John Castaldo, who's joining us on the telephone. They're neurologists at Lehigh Valley Hospital in Pennsylvania. Together, they have written The Man with the Iron Tattoo, What Our Patients Have Taught Us About Love, Faith, Forgiveness, and Healing. Larry, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And John, do we have you? I guess we don't have him on the air quite yet. He'll be joining us later. John?
Yes.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here, Dan.
And we're also joined by Dr. Herb Adler. He's a professor of psychiatry and family medicine here at Jefferson and Hospital in Pennsylvania. He's done extensive research on the doctor-patient relationship, specifically lately looking at the physiology of compassion. Herb, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
And you're going to be joining us also. We want to hear your stories about doctor-patient relationships. We want to hear from doctors and patients. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-WHYY. And I have a feeling we're going to be backed up with calls, so if you want to get on the air, call early in the show. So, Larry, let's start with you. The book is subtitled What Our Patients Taught Us About Love, Faith, and Healing. Now, I'm guessing by the color of your hair that when you went through your medical training and your neurology residency, very few of your professors taught you that you should learn about love, faith, and healing from your patients.
Well, actually, some did. Those who I admired then and still remember fondly. John and I decided that we would write up some of these cases that meant a lot to us and from which we learned a lot. Some of the senior professors didn't do as well as some of the younger people.
Do as well with what?
With listening and offering to patients hope and faith. When you mention that, I happen to think of my favorite story. There are 13 stories in this book. 7 are John's and 6 are mine. My favorite one is called A Vigil for Anna, in which my wife's grandmother, at age 80, was admitted to the New York hospital with a high fever and rash and a stroke and a heart attack. And the senior doctor basically gave up on her, said to me as a fourth-year student, "When it's all over, we will call you. You can go back to your apartment." We were devastated, not only I, but my wife Eva and her parents, hearing that this 80-year-old lady who had survived Auschwitz was basically given up within the first few minutes. The intern in the case, Tim Weld, by the way, still around, said to us, "He's not giving up. He doesn't know why she came," and he stayed up with her all night. And to make a long story short, she walked out of the hospital. Lived 10 years after that. And he demonstrated to us the importance of faith and love and the role that that can play in healing.
Well, you bring up an interesting and tricky word here, and that's hope. And too many doctors convey to their patients that there is no hope. But I think you can err on the other side, too, and that's giving hope when there really isn't any and offering hope just because you have anxiety about breaking bad news to the patients. Herb, do you have any thoughts or experience about this business of hope in patient care?
Hope works best when it's most credible. And it's most credible when the patient experiences you as really listening to what they have to say. And when you've listened to what they have to say, and then you respond both with a way of understanding what they said and the emotional messages connected with that, then you're maximizing the benefits of hope. Hope is an emotion, just as fear is. And when the patient feels safe and credibly hopeful, then their self-reparative biological healing system works maximally.
I've got to be candid about where I weigh in on this hope business personally. When I first became a quadriplegic, I was told, there's no hope for you. And in hindsight, that was a gift to me, because many of my cohorts went home with spinal cord injury believing that one day they could walk again, and they languished in their home waiting for some unreasonable hope. And I spent a long time thinking and writing often about the gifts of hopelessness. And I struggled with what hope really meant until I read Jerome Groopman's book about the anatomy of hope. And he said hope is the belief that tomorrow can be better than today.
You know, Dan, I think, this is John Cataldo.
Yes.
I think that we have to be careful as physicians, however, because we don't have crystal balls. And I think we can sometimes think that our science and our imaging is so successful in helping to make a diagnosis, and our experience so rich that we can predict the future. And sometimes we can. And a good example is a patient who I just saw a couple of weeks ago. Larry, I haven't told you about this, but it's a young man who was in a motor vehicle accident, and he had been in a coma and transferred down to our center, and it reminded me much of my son. In the story of the book, I relate about my son who was in a similar accident. But the family had been told by the people at the outside institution that their son would make a good recovery. And when he arrived to me, he was in a minimally conscious state, not quite a vegetative state, but certainly just above a coma. The family related that they thought sometimes he would look at them, but other times not. He was basically quadriplegic in bed with very minimal activity. When I looked at his scans, he had what we call herniation of brain tissue, which is swelling and shift and brainstem compression. And I looked at those scans and I felt hopeless. And I went to the family with a heavy heart and felt I was the bearer of bad news, and they telling them that I did not think there was much chance that he would recover. They were very tearful, and they said, you know, we thank you for being very honest, because we always felt that someone was giving us false hopes. And then they said, but we don't want to give up hope. And I said, you know, I don't want to give up hope either. And I think that there's always room for miracles. I said, maybe science says that he doesn't have a chance, but I said, there's always room for miracles, and let us leave the window open for that. 10 days later, this young man walked out of the hospital.
Which is a similar story to what happened with your son.
Yeah, I mean, it was totally unexpected. He was catching a ball with them. He was interacting with them. It wasn't normal, but he certainly wasn't a case of someone who you would simply send to hospice and give up.
I want to come back to you, Herb, this business of the doctor-patient relationship. Now, way back when, that wasn't talked about much at all in medical school and in training. I mean, you went through a psychiatric residency. It had to be talked about then. But I wonder how it was talked about. I mean, my vision is many years ago, and maybe even today, the doctor-patient relationship was talked about in a linear way, like doctor as offering therapy to patient who is ill, no sense of mutuality.
Yes, and all the studies show that medical outcome is much better with a satisfying physician-patient relationship, and that has generally been attributed to the fact that the patient's going to follow directions better. There's more adherence. They're going to take the medicine. They're going to change their lifestyle. But we're beginning to understand now that a good relationship in and of itself, just as a relationship, is a physiologic transfusion.
Say more. What do you mean?
In any engagement, parent-child, doctor-patient, spouses, you're not just exchanging conversation, and you're not just in a coordinated social interaction, which when if you film it, you see two people who are dancing and orchestrating each other's movement. You're also mutually regulating each other's physiology, so that when you're close to someone, when you're engaged in them, someone, they feel anxious, you feel anxious, they feel happy, you feel happy. And one of the things that happens foundationally in a doctor-patient relationship is that the doctor engages the patient's emotions and modulates them. A very useful illustration of that is the mother-infant relationship. Right after birth, the mother and infant get into a dance of physiologic attunement in which she regulates his autonomic stability for life sometimes.
Hmm. And I know this is not taught in most medical schools.
Well, it's one of those things that's always done and not talked about explicitly. Right. The fact is, the biologic feedback loop is always there. One of the phrases we use in teaching family medicine at Jefferson is getting into the cage with the patient. And that image is taken from a study in which they induced gastric ulcers in a rat by giving them electric shocks over a period of, say, 6 hours. And it would take 6 hours for a rat to get a gastric ulcer if it was alone. But if they put in a litter mate, it had to be a litter mate, not a strange rat, it more than doubled their resistance to shock. So what we're trying to convey is get into the cage with the patient, and their story is a way of getting into their cage.
Well, now we're not just talking about doctor-patient relationships. We're talking about relationships.
Yes.
I treated a man who was brutally beaten by his father. He lived alone with his father and his paternal grandmother, who was old and frail and not able to do anything. And I said, "How did you survive?" And he said, "When my father was beating me, I looked up and I saw my grandmother was watching with anguish in her eyes. And I knew in a way we were in it together. And that's how we survived." What we're talking about is compassion and the physiology of compassion.
You know, as I look back, this is John Castaldo again.
Yes.
I look back on my training, there was a lot of emphasis on not becoming too emotionally involved with your patients, right, that this would color your ability to make objective decisions. You were the scientist. You were to listen objectively and concentrate on dissecting the symptoms. You know, we had a term, symptomatology, a term I hated, which meant, you know, the study of the symptoms, not necessarily the study of the patient. But over time, I've really felt just the opposite. I felt that a little bit, as Herb was saying, I think that patients come to bond with you when they feel that you are sharing their emotions, when you suffer with them to some extent. And that compassion is, you know, more than an empathy. I think it's a sense of being willing to get in that cage, as was mentioned, to get in there and fight with them the good fight. I think too often when we have computers and technology and images between us and the patient, we appear to them as cold and unconcerning. And it's the human touch which heals more than the scientific knowledge of the disease sometimes.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Janine waiting to join us. Janine, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. What a fascinating subject. I'm calling because I have a family member who works for the organization that creates the medical boards. And he has told me that there is now an interactive component with an actor to the medical to the exam that's given to candidates. And I'm just wondering if anything is being done to ensure that that interactive component of the exam is not only testing for, you know, the science of practicing medicine, you know, asking the right questions, gathering the right data, which from what he's told me, kind of it sounds like, you know, you're trying to tease out information, but how much attention is being paid to the compassion and caring aspect of the interaction with the patient. I don't know if you guys know much about that or have strong opinions. It sounds like you should. So,
well, I'm sure all my guests, including the host of the show, have strong opinions about that. I don't know if any of my three guests are knowledgeable about what goes on in medical board testing these days. Anybody want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think I can take a shot at that. Having been an examiner for the neurology boards, I think there is a sense that we look to see that a trainee is compassionate in their tone of voice, that they appear to be gentle and kind to a patient, and that they appear to be taking their symptoms of pain and discomfort seriously. But I think that falls far short of compassion and empathy and getting into the cage with the patient of being their servant, champion, and silent sufferer with them. I think there is a little bit difference to that.
I want to play devil's advocate with you and help highlight a problem here. If you are the examiner, John, and you're looking at my ability to be empathic, and you see that I fail that abysmally, and I fail the boards because of that, I'm very likely going to sue you and put you on the hook for having your own bias. How can you measure something like that in me? It's not objective.
Well, we've done that in our medical residency. We have, in fact, failed to graduate residents who consistently have treated their patients coldly or have had bad reports from their patients that they have been unkind. So I do think that happens. Now, in the boards, when you're actually giving the oral boards, and Larry has done this longer than I have, people can be pretty good actors. I mean, you watch them examine patients, three or four of them, on the stand, and they're under a lot of stress, and it's kind of an artificial situation. But when you're in training residents, I think clearly you can see someone that doesn't belong in this field, and I would argue that bad behavior is one that has to be sought out and weeded out, and that some people should not proceed in this profession.
I am inclined to agree with you. I didn't disagree. I just fear that measuring, taking a look at these issues that are so critical are not objective and able to be documented and measured and seen, then that puts the examiner at risk for being accused of bias. It's a very difficult way to go. We struggled with the psychology boards too. It's essential and it's risky at the same time. We've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation and a lot of issues I want to address. We've also got to take a short break. We're going to come back after a very brief break and come back and talk about this business of compassion and can hearing be taught, real hearing be taught. We're talking about the doctor-patient relationship. Today my guests are Dr. Lawrence Larry Levitt and John Castaldo, the neurologists at Lehigh Valley Hospital. And they've written The Man with the Iron Tattoo, What Our Patients Have Taught Us About Love, Faith, Forgiveness, and Healing. I'm also joined by Dr. Herb Adler. He's a professor of psychiatry and family medicine here at Jefferson and has published extensively on the issue of the doctor-patient relationship. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Are you pregnant and depressed? Looking for an alternative to medication? Penn has a research study to evaluate an investigational magnetic device for depression. If you aren't on antidepressants during your pregnancy and are 18 to 34 years old, you may qualify. All study evaluations and procedures will be provided at no cost by Penn doctors. To learn more, 215-662-2815. 215-662-2815.
When you listen to WHYY, you hear the quality news, information, and perspectives you expect. But you also listen to hear what you don't always expect. Interviews or an angle on a big news story that you haven't heard anywhere else. As we near the end of our fiscal year, we'll continue to meet your expectations, but we can only do it with your support. Make a donation by June 30th and help us meet our goals. 1-888-345-WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. The all-important doctor patient relationship, how to listen, how to care, what impact does it have really on us as patients and on them as doctors? My guests are Dr. Herb Adler. He's a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at Jefferson, studies this topic extensively. Dr. Lawrence Levitt and John Castaldo are neurologists at Lehigh Valley Hospital. And together they have written The Man with the Iron Tattoo, stories of patients they have treated and learned from. Larry, I have a question of you about this balance. All of your patients want care and compassion. They want you to be human, but they also want emotional strength, self-confidence, technical skills. What's the balance there?
That's a good question. I think that we need to try our best to be good scientists. We can't negate that. Without good science and gathering the data, actually my son has a favorite expression that he learned from his mentor, without the data, the chatter don't matter. So we need the data, and we need to be good scientists and gather the data. But in addition to that, we need to use that data carefully, thoughtfully, with, as was earlier said, credible relationships with our patients. But I think that balance can be struck. It's hard. Doctors have a tough job these days with HMOs and PHOs and all, and the time restraint that they often have in solving problems. But I think the patient knows when their doctor is truly interested in their case and is sympathetic and empathetic. And I think that balance is difficult. But when I think about the doctors that I looked up to, that I had great respect for, they seem to have that balance. We should try to emulate them and not just collect a lot of data.
John, when you walk into a patient's room or an examining room, you have on your shoulder, you've got the patient before that you were seeing, that you might be thinking about, or the patient, seven patients before them. You've got patients in the waiting room, patients in the next examining room, short on time. You've got your managed care is telling you you can only spend X amount of time with a patient or else you go broke, and there's a lawyer floating around somewhere saying, you know, one screw up and you're going to be in court. And then what all of us are saying is you have to walk in that room and listen. How do you listen with that cacophony of issues and voices in your head? Too much to ask.
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think I have a little mental game I play to help with that. I imagine the brain is this great big mansion of many different rooms, and there are many different doors, some wonderful rooms and some not so wonderful rooms. And I try to go into one at a time, and as I leave one room, I shut the door and go to the next. So when I go into that room, it's a wonderful opportunity to really focus on one person. I try to get to know them as a person, and that makes it a whole lot easier. You know a little bit about what they do with their spare time, their hobbies, their kids. So they're really more like family. If you think of your patient as a family coming in, it's very easy to focus on them. And then I think the hard part is when they have lots of different symptoms and they have difficult diagnoses and you have a whole array of tests that are ordered, trying to balance the science of those tests, trying to share it with them in a non-threatening way, in a way that they can understand, and trying to shepherd them through the maze of multiple consultants, medications, side effects to get them better. So I don't have so much trouble with the focus part. I think we all struggle with giving 100% of our concentration with listening, but it's the balancing, I think, of what Larry puts, the tremendous amount of data today, and trying in a very short period of time to have a human relationship with that person.
There is a great yoga teacher who once said, every time you go into a room, wake up. Notice that you're in a new room, a new place. It's just that simple. It's hard to be conscious of that, but just that simple. I said in my opening billboard, what I request of my doctors is before you ask me how I am, ask me who I am, just who I am. My article in today's papers, four words that'll change the world. Tell me your story. And then be quiet. Mm-hmm. Just, and then listen for a little bit. Just tell me your story. I don't think it takes a great deal of time. Can that be taught, Herb? Can we teach people to listen?
Yes, we can. And let me add, and this is not even remotely to put the responsibility on the patient, since we're all different doctors with different patients.
Yeah.
And some patients, we will have a range, bring out the top of our emotional range and some of the bottom of our emotional range. And when a patient says, how are you, doctor? It is a connector. It's almost impossible not to build a bridge. And your question was how do you learn to listen? For one thing, you have to be curious. You have to really wonder what's going on with that patient, and you have to get the satisfactions of engaging another human being. That's enormously satisfying, and that's probably one of the major reasons people went into medicine. Let's kick the ball around till we get a game.
That pronoun being critical. We.
Yes.
We. Let's go back to the phones. Our phone lines are jammed. There's lots of people who want to come in. I've been selfish. We've got Betty on the line.
Betty, hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I enjoy the show, and I want to thank the physicians who are participating. I'm a registered nurse who founded a company about 3 years ago called Guardian Nurses Healthcare Advocates. And what's interesting to me as I'm listening to the doctors is that many of them have had experiences themselves on a personal level that really clearly made an impact on how they interact with their patients following following that experience. And in our work as patient advocates, our stories and the patients that we deal with, you know, often involve poor relationships with physicians and with the healthcare system itself. And as the doctors are saying, it really is all about communication. I mean, our greatest successes are when we can plug our patients into systems or physicians who really do listen to them and who will partner with them and really establish a good relationship with them. So I'm glad you're having this discussion. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. I want to read a poem that I recently read. It's a poem written by a woman who was a guest on this show 2 years ago. She was on the phone. She lives in New Hampshire. She was diagnosed in 2003 with ALS. And as we all know, her life is slowly drifting away as the disease climbs up her body. She's a clergyman. She's a poet. She's a woman with great intellect and great insight. I want to read a poem that she just sent to me. Her name is Jane Babin, by the way, B-A-B-I-N, a poem that was just sent to me a couple days ago. It's called Compassion. My doctor gave me a hug today in his office at the end of my appointment. He said, "You need a hug," and then wrapped his arms around me. I never expected the intimacy of his concern. Alone, for so many years, one becomes accustomed to the lack of touch. Yet it felt warm and pleasant, like rubbing one's hands over a fire on a bitter winter day. Perhaps he saw the resignation in my eyes and felt connected to my fear. But there was sadness in his eyes as well. It came to me later in the day as I pondered his hug, his words, that he was really talking to himself, addressing years of anguish over his son, who, like me, is trapped in a wasting body. For one moment, he saw his dying son in me. And in that space, arms wrapped around each other, comfort and pain merged and sped off the sky. Jane Babin. It's powerful, wonderful poet. So when we feel compassion, when we feel truly knowing, are we talking about our own experience or others? Whose heart are we talking about? Larry?
I think that is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful poem. And the opportunity that we have from learning from our patients and making us better is the challenge, I think, of physicians. And it reminds me that, by the way, not only do you have the opportunity to bond with your patient, you have the opportunity to bond with the patient's family. And an experience, if I may relate it, that changed my whole life came from a chapter in the book called Encountering Leonard. And that chapter, as you may recall, involved a woman who was brought to Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, dying, having basically been given up in Allentown.
That was your first patient, wasn't it?
That was one of my first patients, yes. And her husband slept on the couch in her hospital room. And we were convinced that he just didn't have enough money for a hospital room or for a meal, and it was my wife, Eva, who insisted that I bring him home for dinner. She fed him chicken and carrots, and to make a long story short, after his wife did improve, because she had a treatable, reversible part of her cancer, I was called to the president's office, Mr. Vanderwalker, and I was sure that I was fired. Why would a first-year resident be called to the president's office? He said, "Are you Levitt?" I said, "I am." He said, "Don't be so nervous. Everything's okay." And again, he said, Mr. Poole was just here. You just took care of his wife, Dorothy. And he appreciated the care that Dr. Geller, who was her real doctor, and you gave her. And he just donated $1 million to Memorial Sloan Kettering. Well, I almost fainted from almost being fired. And that changed my whole life. It was subsequently that I was invited to Allentown. I developed neurology in Allentown. But so not only do we have the opportunity to bond with a patient, but sometimes you have the opportunity to bond with a family of a patient. And this opportunity, as the patient describes in that poem, is unique and I think a blessing if it occurs.
Most medical schools, most supervisors would frown on that, not let you do that. As a matter of fact, might even technically be an ethics violation. Obviously, you did the right thing, of course. There's no argument there. And it was very humanitarian for you to do. And thank God there was a payoff, too, a literal payoff. But you're not going to get a young resident's not going to get a whole lot of permission to do that. Herb?
I'd like to reinforce the mutual healing message in the poem, that one of the impetus for listening to patient's story is that we are healing ourselves as well as the patient. And that was, there's the legend of the wounded healer in folklore, and the way one becomes a healer in non-industrial countries is you get sick, and then you get healed, and then, and this is critical, you have a calling, you must go out and heal others as you've been healed, otherwise you get sick again.
We have to take a break, but, my mantra, Herb, is that Hippocrates said that inside of every patient there's a healer, and Gottlieb says inside of every healer there's a patient, and unless all four come to the entity, to the relationship, there's a lie in the room, and that lie is going to create harm.
Yes.
Somehow there's a lie. We've got to take another break. We'll be back in just 60 seconds and get to some of these dear patient people who have been waiting on the phone for 40 minutes. We're talking about the doctor-patient relationship today with Dr. Larry Levitt, John Castaldo. They're neurologist at Lehigh Valley Hospital, and they've written The Man with the Iron Tattoo. Dr. Herb Adler is a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at Jefferson. He studies and has published many articles on this very topic, the doctor-patient relationship. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
The Pentagon calls it propaganda.
Still the paper do I pen, knowing what but never when. As dreams begin and nightmares end, I'm homeward bound to beloved tend.
The Guantanamo Bay prisoners who wrote it call it poetry.
It's remarkable that poetry is being classified as an act of war.
A book from behind the walls of Guantanamo Bay.
Begins this journey without reins.
Next time on Day to Day.
Without aims, now lying in the cellar.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I was about to say we're back on doctor-patient relationships. It's both. We are. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. I'm joined by Dr. Larry Levitt and John Castaldo. They're neurologists out in Lehigh Hospital in Allentown. And they've written The Man with the Iron Lung. Here I'm also joined by Dr. Herb Adler, professor of psychiatry and family medicine at Jefferson, who studies the topic extensively. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Jude on the line.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Of course.
I wanted really to initially make a comment, but after having listened to what you've said, I have something else I'd like to say as well. I have had a chronic illness now. I've been living with a chronic illness for about 16 years. And one of the things that sort of evolved within me is that I think initially I really did hope to find a physician who would have the ability to properly read and sort of empathize and guide my treatment. And I realize that I'm almost asking for a sort of super amount of wisdom and completeness in an individual that may not be reasonable to expect. I've come close at times as to having found people who have been very balanced and extremely assistant in helping me. But I've also found many physicians who had a great deal of difficulty even not just listening to me, but not sort of feeling that, you know, it was sort of their way or the highway, that somehow my subjective experience wasn't to be trumped by their knowledge. And it's been extraordinarily difficult. But at any rate, I'll take your response, if any, off the air.
One quick
thanks so much.
Jude, do we have you?
Yeah, you sure do.
All right. Can I ask you in about 15 seconds
sure.
to describe this doctor that you have in your head?
Well, someone who is extremely balanced and grounded and under just almost intuitively, this is fair to say, has a sense of sort of appropriate, I hate to call it boundaries. I don't mean to be setting up boundaries, essentially. But, you know, I don't want someone to be dragged into the mess with me. And yet I do need someone who can provide insight coupled with an understanding that I have to live in this body and that I'm experiencing the responses to treatment, not the physicians themselves.
Okay.
I also should say that I finally sought a therapist to help me sort of work through my relationships with the physicians I treat with. And that's been extraordinarily helpful.
Yeah,
because she's been able to provide that peace.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not so sure that's unreasonable. I want to hear from the experts, and I appreciate your call. I don't think what you're asking for is unreasonable, but let's let our experts weigh in. Thanks for your call, Jude, and best of luck with what you're living with. Mm-hmm. Anybody, Larry?
I think
Herb. Sorry, Herb.
I think if I'm understanding June, what she's asking for is a modulated empathic response. I mean, she wants the physician to be able to share her feelings, but not so intensely that that the feelings get kindled. And it's a process that I would describe as hemodialysis, that you want to the patient, the physician to be able to engage the intensity and the toxicity of your feelings and process it in a compassionate way and send it back to you detoxified so that you can co-process it together.
Well, that's what psychotherapists do. I mean, I don't know if that's unreasonable to ask a physician or not. I mean, when I'm with my patients, I care very deeply. When they're in anguish, almost not a day goes by I'm not moved to tears and feel deeply. And when my patients fear opening up a door inside themselves and they fear they're going to break down or explode, I can say, okay, we'll put you back together. I've got that boundary here. You'll be okay because I'm here and I'll make sure you're okay. So that's what we do. But is it reasonable to ask a physician to do that? Let me turn to you, Larry.
I'm going to ask John to take this one because I think he has taught me so much about changing his own behavior from patients that he has treated. I can think of several examples in the book. But, John, I'm going to pass that to you because I think you've done that better than most.
Well, I think it, you know, as all have said, it is truly an important balance. You need to be able to listen. I think you have to share emotion, but as Herb said, not kindle it. I don't think it's a crying session, but I think you do have to let the patient see that you feel with them on their level. You will champion their cause with them, not just from your head, but from your heart. That is the connector. Not that you have a lot of information in your head and that perhaps, you know, they could get that from the internet or they could get that from Google. They're looking for a champion of their cause, and I think they have to feel as though you look at them like a family member. And in the poem, you know, I thought it was wonderful that this person was so touched by the doctor hugging them. You know, I actually confess I hug my patients a lot. But in some circles, that's frowned on. And in some places, you have to be very careful that that's not taken the wrong way.
And yes, you could lose your license for that in some circles.
You can. And I think it, you know, it has to be at the appropriate time. It has to be at the appropriate place. It has to be heartfelt. And then there aren't any questions about it. It can't be faked. It has to be genuine, authentic, spontaneous, and it has to be mutual. And then there is the feeling that you are on their side, emotionally sharing their problems and that you are helping them.
Let's take another phone call. We've got Diane on the line. Diane, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm from the Lehigh Valley, and I have a physicians group at Lehigh Valley Hospital, and my doctor, my family doctor, is one that I have a very good relationship. I trust him. I like him. We have a great relationship. Well, their practice is no longer going to the hospital. So when, and this is a common occurrence now, when I go to the hospital when I'm really sick, which I'm lucky I haven't been, I have to see a hospitalist who doesn't know me, who I don't know, who's going to decide what care I'm getting, what services I'm going to have, what orthopedist I will get if I get one, what neurologist I will get. And I think this is outrageous for patient-doctor relationships. Why?
I couldn't agree with you more. Why? Well, I guess we're going to have to look at the economics of medicine. I'll ask if one of our experts has a comment on that. I doubt if anybody's happy with it. Thanks for calling, Diane. Larry?
I can understand the unhappiness. Unfortunately, it's become a reality that doctors just are not as expert in all fields of medicine, especially in critical care, as they might like to be. And so hospitalists and intensivists have been created to deal with very, very sick patients. I know John took care of a very, very sick patient yesterday who a hospitalist is helping to bail out of a serious situation. So I don't know what the answer is yet. This is a tough problem, but it has been hoisted on us because of the complexity and difficulty there is with taking care of very sick patients.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to seeing what happens with the fallout of the much-anticipated movie Sicko, because we really do have to re-examine the whole healthcare system top to bottom. And the bottom line, I think all of us agree, really does have to do with relationships. Herb, what can we do? Or what can doctors do to care for themselves?
Well, paradoxically, caring for patients is caring for ourselves. I mean, one might think that when you get into the cage, you're more susceptible to burnout, but quite the opposite is true. The remedy for burnout is engaging the patient's humanity, with connecting them with your own. Doctors can have lots of support from their personal life, but an enormous amount of support doctors get are from the satisfactions of helping patients and themselves vicariously.
I want to nuance that a little bit, Herb. What about this issue of caring too much causing burnout? And it does.
It's what causes burnout is frustration. The difficult patient is not someone with a difficult medical problem. The patient you can't form a therapeutic alliance with. Once you form the alliance and you're connected, it's so satisfying that it helps both of you.
Yeah, I my experience is that burnout, no matter what caring profession you're in, that burnout is about trying to do something you can't do, and that simple caring and compassion, you're right, it feeds both patient and doctor. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and I want to apologize to all the callers that didn't get in and thank the callers that did and that tried. I want to thank my guests. You guys have been great. Dr. Larry Levitt and John Castaldo, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your great book, The Man with the Iron Tattoo.
Thank you, Dan.
I also want to thank Dr. Herb Adler, Professor of Psychiatry and Family Medicine here at Jefferson University. Thanks, Herb, and thanks for the work you do.
My pleasure.
Well, if you've got a question, comment, you want to give us some advice about future shows, we're at whyvoices@whyy.org. You can also reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Shane Ewing is our intern. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters, she's our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Day to day.